4. Unable to sleep, plagued by bad dreams, a boy named Michael Henlon rose soon after first light on the first full day of summer vacation. The light was pale, bundled up in a low, thick mist that would lift by 8 o'clock, taking the rapture of a perfect summer day. But that was for later. For now, the world was all grey and rose, as silent as a cat walking on a carpet. Mike, dressed in corduroys, a t-shirt, and black high-topped cats, came downstairs, ate a bowl of Wheaties. He didn't really like Wheaties, but had wanted the free price in the box, a Captain Midnight Magic decoder ring. Then, hopped on his bike and pedaled toward town, riding on the sidewalks because of the fog. The fog changed everything, made the most ordinary things like fire hydrants and stop signs into objects of mystery. Things both strange and a trifle sinister. You could hear cars but not see them, and because of the fog's odd acoustic quality, you could not tell if they were far or near until you actually saw them come rolling out of the fog with ghost halos of moisture raining their headlamps. He turned right on Jackson Street by passing downtown, and then crossed to Main Street by way of Palmer Lane. And during his short ride down this little byway's one block length, he passed the house where he would live as an adult. He did not look at it. It was just a small two-story dwelling with a garage and a small lawn. It gave off no special vibration to the passing boy, who would spend most of his adult life as its owner and only dweller. At Main Street, he turned right and rode up to Basie Park, still wondering, simply riding, enjoying the stillness of the early day. Once inside the main gate, he dismounted his bike, paused on the kickstand, and walked toward the kennel. He was still, as far as he knew, impelled by nothing more than purest to him. Certainly, it did not occur to him to think that his dreams of the night before had anything to do with his current curse. He did not even remember exactly what his dreams had been. Only that one had followed another until he had awakened at 5 o'clock, sweaty but shivering, and with the idea that he ought to eat a fast breakfast and then take a bike ride into town. Here in Basie, there was a smell in the fog he didn't like. A sea smell, salty and old. He had smelled it before, of course. In the early morning fogs, you could often smell the ocean in Derry, although the coast was 40 miles away. But the smell this morning seemed thicker, more vital, almost dangerous. Something caught his eye. He went down and picked up a cheap two-blade pocket knife. Someone had scratched the initials EC on the side. Mike looked at it thoughtfully for a moment or two and then pocketed it. Finders keepers, losers whippers. He glanced around. Here, near where he had found the knife, was an overturned park bench. He righted it, setting its iron footings back into the holes they had made over a period of months or years. Beyond the bench, he saw a matted place in the grass, and leading away from it, two groups. The grass was springing back up, but those groups were still fairly clear. They went in the direction of the canal, and there was blood. But he did not want to remember the bird, and so he pushed the thought away. Dogfight, that's all. One of them must have hurt the other one pretty bad. It was a convincing thought, by which he was somehow not convinced. Thoughts of the bird kept wanting to come back. The one he had seen out at the Kitchener Ironworks, one Stan Uris, never would have found in his bird book. Stop it. Just get out of here. But instead of getting out, he followed the groups. As he did, he made up a little story in his mind. It was a murder story. Here's this kid, out late, see? Out past the curfew. The killer gets him. And how does he get rid of the body? Drags it to the kennel and dumps it in. Of course. Just like an Alfred Hitchcock presents. The marks he was following could have been made by a dragging pair of shoes or sneakers, he supposed. Mike shivered and looked around uncertainly. The story was somehow a little too real. And suppose that it wasn't a man who did it, but a monster. Like out of a horror comic, or a horror book, or a horror movie, or bathroom, a fairy tale or something. He decided he didn't like the story. It was a stupid story. He tried to push it out of his mind, but it wouldn't go. So what? Let it stay. And it was Dump. Riding into town this morning had been Dump. Following these two matted groups in the grass was Dump. His dad would have a lot of chores for him to do around the place today. He had to get back and start in, or when the hottest part of the afternoon rolled around, he would be up the barn loft pitching hay. Yes, he ought to get back. And that's just what he was going to do.
Sure you are,
he thought.
Want to bet?
Instead of going back to his bike and getting on and riding home and starting his chores, he followed the grooves in the grass. There were more drops of drying blood here and there. Not much, though. Not as much as there had been in that matted place back there by the park bench he had set to rights. Mike could hear the colonel now, running quiet. A moment later, he saw the concrete edge materialize out of the fog. Here was something else in the grass.
My goodness, it's certainly your day for finding things,
his mind said with dubious geniality, and then a girl screamed somewhere and Mike flinched, thinking again of the bear he had seen that day just this spring.
Whatever that is in the grass, I don't even want to look at it.
And that was, oh, so very true. But here he was, already bending over it, hands planted just above his knees, to see what it was. A tattered bit of cloth with a drop of blood on it. The seagull screamed again. Mike stirred the bloody scrap of cloth and remembered what had happened to him in the spring. 5. Each year during April and May, the Henlon farm woke up from its winter doze. Mike would let himself know that spring had come again, not when the first crocuses showed under his mom's kitchen windows, or when kids started bringing immies in croakers to school, or even when the Washington Senators kicked off the baseball season, usually getting themselves liked in the process. But only when his father hollered for Mike to help him push their mongrel truck out of the barn. The front half was an old Model A Ford car. The back end, a pickup truck with a tailgate, which was the remainder of the old henhouse door. If the winter hadn't been too cold, the two of them could often get it going by pushing it down the driveway. The truck's cab had no doors. Likewise, there was no windshield. The seat was half of an old sofa that Will Henlon had scrunched from the door with damp. The stick shift ended in a glass doorknob. They would push it down the driveway, one on each side, and when it got rolling good, Will would jump in, turn on the switch, retard the spark, step down on the clutch, punch the shift into first gear with his big hand clamped over the doorknob. Then he would holler,
"Put me over the hump!"
He'd pop the clutch and the old Ford engine would cuff, choke, chuck, backfire, and sometimes actually start to run, rough at first, then smoothing out. Will would roar down the road to a reeling farms, turn around in the driveway. If he had gone the other way, Henry Bower's crazy father Butch probably would have blown his head off with a shotgun. And then roar back. The muffled engine blotting stridently while Mike jumped up and down with excitement, cheering. And his mom stood in the kitchen doorway, wiping her hands on a dish towel and pretending a disgust she didn't really feel. Other times, the truck wouldn't roll start, Mike would have to wait until his father came back from the barn, gouring the crank and muttering under his breath. Mike was quite sure that some of the words so muttered were swears, and he would be a little frightened of his dad then. It wasn't until much later, during one of those interminable visits to the hospital room where Will Henlon lay dying, that he found out his father muttered because he was afraid of the crank. Once it had kicked back viciously, flown out of its socket, and torn the side of his mouth open.
"Stand back, Mikey,"
he would say, slipping the crank into its socket at the base of the radiator. And when the A was finally running, he'd say that next year he was going to trade it for a Chevrolet, but he never did. That old A Ford hybrid was still in back of the home place, up to its axles, in henhouse tailgating weeds. When it was running, and Mike was sitting in the passenger seat, smelling hot oil and blue exhaust, excited by the keen breeze that washed in through the glassless hole where the windshield had once been, he would think,
"Spring's here again, we're all waking up."
And in his soul, he would raise a silent cheer that shook the walls of that mostly cheerful room.
He felt love for everything around him, and most of all for his dad, who would grin over at him and holler, "Hold on, Mikey, we gon' wind this baby up, we gon' make some birds run for cover." Then he would tear up the driveway. The ace, roar, wheels, spitting back black dirt and grey clots of clay. Both of them jouncing up and down on the sofa seat inside the open cab, laughing like stark natural born fools. Will would run the A through the high grass of the backfield, which was kept for her, toward either the south field, potatoes, the west field, corn and beans, or the east field, peas, squash, and pumpkins. As they went, birds would burst up out of the grass before the truck, squawking in terror. Once a partridge flew up, a magnificent bird as brown as late autumn oaks, the explosive coughing whirr of its wings audible even over the bounding canyon. Those rides were Mike Hanlon's door into spring. The year's work began with the rock harvest. Every day for a week, they would take the hay out and load the bed with rocks which might break a harrow blade when the time came to turn the earth and plant. Sometimes, the truck would get stuck in the mucky spring earth, and Will would mutter darkly under his breath. "More source," Mike surmised. He knew some of the words and expressions. Others, such as "son of a war," puzzled him. He had come across the word in the Bible, and so far as he could tell, a war was a woman who came from a place called Babylon. He had once set out to ask his father, but the hay had been in mud up to her cold springs. There had been thunderclouds on his father's brow, and he had decided to wait for a better time. He ended up asking Richie Tozier later that year, and Richie told him his father had told him a war was a woman who got paid for having sex with men.
"What's having sex?"
Mike had asked, and Richie had wandered away holding his head. On one occasion, Mike had asked his father why. Since they harvested rocks every April, there were always more of them the following April. They had been standing at the dumping-off place near sunset on the last day of that year's rock harvest. A beaten dirt track, not quite serious enough to be called the road, led from the bottom of the Westfield to this gully near the bank of the Kandiskeg. The gully was a jumbled wasteland of rocks that had been dragged off Will's land through the years. Looking down at this butland, which he had made first alone, and then with the help of his son, somewhere under the rocks, he knew, were the rotting remains of the stems he had yanked out one at a time before any of the fields could be tilled. Will had lighted a cigarette and said,
"My daddy used to tell me that God loves rocks, houseflies, weeds, and poor people above all the rest of his creations, and that's why he made so many of them."
"But every year it's like they come back."
"Yeah, I think they do," Will said. "That's the only way I know to explain it."
A loon cried from the far side of the Kandiskeg in a dusky sunset that had turned the water a deep orange red. It was a lonely sound, so lonely that it made Mike's tired arms tighten with goose flesh.
"I love you, Daddy,"
he said suddenly, feeling his love so strongly that tears stung his eyes.
"Why, I love you too, Mikey,"
his father said, and kept him tight in his strong arms. Mike felt the rough fabric of his father's flannel shirt against his cheek.
"Now what do you say we go and back? We got just time to get a bath each before the good woman puts supper on the table."
"Are you?"
Mike said.
"Are you yourself?"
Will Hanlon said, and they both laughed. Feeling tired for feeling good, arms and legs worked, but not overworked. Their hands rock roughened, but not hardened too bad.
"Spring's here,"
Mike thought that night, rushing off in his room while his mother and father watched the honeymooners in the other room.
"Spring's here again. Thank you, God. Thank you very much."
And turning to sleep, sinking down, he had heard the loon call again, the distance of its morses blending into the desire of his dreams. Spring was a busy time, but it was a good time. Following the rock harvest, Will would park the hay in the high grass back of the house and drive the tractor out of the barn. There would be harrowing then, his father driving the tractor, Mike either riding behind and holding onto the iron seat, or walking alongside, picking up any rocks they had missed and throwing them aside. Then came planting, and following the planting came summer's work. Hoeing, hoeing, hoeing. His mother would refurbish Larry, Moe, and Curly.
the freest crackers, and Mike would help his father put moose blowers on top of each straw-filled head. A moose blower was a can with both ends cut off. You tie the length of heavily waxed and rosin string tightly across the middle of the can, and when the wind blew through it, a wonderfully spooky sound resulted. A kind of whining croak. Crop-eating birds decided soon enough that Larry, Moe, and Curly were no threats, but the moose blowers always frightened them off. Starting in July, there was picking as well as hoeing. Peas and radishes first, then the lettuce and tomatoes that had been started in the set boxes, then the corn and beans in August, more corn and beans in September, then the pumpkins and the squash. Somewhere in the midst of all that came the new potatoes, and then, as the days shortened and the year sharpened, he and his dad would take in the moose blowers, and sometime during the winter they would disappear. It seemed they had to make new ones each spring. The day after, Will would call Norman Sadler, who was as dumb as his son Moose, but infinitely more good-hearted, and Normie would come over with his potato digger. For the next 3 weeks, all of them would work picking potatoes. In addition to the family, Will would hire 3 or 4 high school boys to help pick, paying them a quarter a barrel. The A4s would cruise slowly up and down the rows of the south field, the biggest field, always in low gear. The tailgate down, the back filled with barrels, each marked with the name of the person picking into it, and at the end of the day, Will would open his old creased wallet and pay each of the pickers cash money. Mike was paid, and so was his mother. That money was theirs, and Will Henlon never once asked either of them what they did with it. Mike had been given a 5% interest in the farm when he was 5 years old. Old enough, Will had told him then to hold a hoe and to tell the difference between witchgrass and peatlands. Each year he had been given another 1%, and each year, on the day after Thanksgiving, Will would compute the farm's profits and deduct Mike's share. But Mike never saw any of that money. It went into his college account and was to be touched under absolutely no other circumstances. At last, the day would come when Normie Sadler drove his potato digger back home. By then, the air would have most likely turned grey and cold, and there would be frost on the drift of orange pumpkins piled against the side of the barn. Mike would stand in the dooryard, his nose red, his dirty hands stuffed into his jeans pockets, and watch as his father drove first the tractor and then the A4 back into the barn. He would think, "We're getting ready to go to sleep again. Spring vanished, summer gone, harvest time done." All that was left now was the bud end of autumn. Leafless trees, frozen ground, a lacing of ice along the banks of the Kenduskeg. In the fields, crows would sometimes land on the shoulders of Moe, Larry, and Curly, and stay as long as they liked. The scarecrows were voiceless, threatless. Mike would not exactly be dismayed by the thought of another year ending. At 9 and 10, he was still too young to make mortal metaphors, because there was plenty to look forward to. Sledding in McCurran Park, or on Ruling Hill out here in Derrytown if you were brave, although that was mostly for big kids. Ice skating, snowball fights, snow fort building. There was time to think about snow shoeing out for a Christmas tree with his daddy, and time to think about the Nordica downhill skis he might or might not get for Christmas. Winter was good. But watching his father drive the A back into the barn, spring bunny, summer gone, harvest time done, always made him feel sad. The way the squadrons of birds heading south for the winter made him feel sad. Or the way a certain slant of light could sometimes make him feel like crying for no good reason. "We're getting ready to go to sleep again." It was not all schools and chores, chores and school. Will Henlon had told his wife more than once that a boy needed time to go fishing. Even if it wasn't fishing, he was really doing. When Mike came home from school, he first put his books on the TV in the parlor, second made himself some kind of snack. He was particularly partial to peanut butter and onion sandwiches, a taste that made his mother raise her hands in helpless horror. And third, studied the note his father had left him, telling Mike where he, Will, was, and what Mike's chores were. Certain rows to be weeded or picked, baskets to be carried, produce to be rotated, the barn to be swept, and whatever. But on at least one school day a week, and sometimes two, there would be no note. And on these days, Mike would go fishing, even if it wasn't really fishing he was doing. Those were great days. Days when he had no particular place to go, and consequently felt no urge to get there in a hurry. Once in a while, his father left him another sort of note. No chores, one might say. Go over to Old Cape and look at trolley tracks. Mike would go over to the Old Cape area, find the streets with the tracks still embedded in them, and inspect them closely, marveling to think of things like trains that had run right through the middle of the streets. That night, he and his father might talk about them, and his dad would show him pictures from his diary album of the trolleys actually running. A funny pole went from the roof of the trolley up to an electrical wire, and there were cigarette jets on the side. Another time, he had sent Mike to Memorial Park, where the standpipe was, to look at the birth bath. And once, they had gone to the courthouse together to look at a terrible machine that Chief Borton had found in the attic. This gadget was called a trumpeter, and was cast iron, and there were manacles built into the arms and legs. Rounded knobs stuck out of the back and set. It reminded Mike of a photograph he had seen in some book, a photograph of the electric chair at Sing Sing. Chief Borton let Mike sit in the trumpeter and try on the manacles. But if the first ominous novelty of wearing the manacles wore off, Mike looked questioningly at his father and Chief Borton, not sure why this was supposed to be such a horrible punishment for the Vex. Borton's words for them. That had drifted into town in the 20s and 30s. The knobs made the chair a little uncomfortable to sit in. Sure, and the manacles on your wrist and ankles made it hard to shift to a more comfortable position. But,
well, you're just a kid, Chief Borton said, laughing. What do you weigh? 70? 80 pounds? Most of the Vax sheriff, surely posted into that chair in the old days, would go twice that. They feel a bit uncomfortable after an hour or so. Really uncomfortable after 2 or 3. Right bad after 4 or 5. After 7 or 8 hours, they'd start bell ring. And after 16 or 17, they start crying, mostly. And by the time their 24-hour tour was up, they'd be willing to swear before God. And man, that the next time they came riding the roads up New England way, they'd give Terry a wide berth. So far as I know, most of them did. 24 hours in the trumpeter was a hell of a persuader.
Suddenly, there seemed to be more knobs in the chair, digging more deeply into his buttocks, spine, the small of his back, even the nape of his neck.
Can I get out now, please? He said politely,
and Chief Borton laughed again. There was a moment, one panicked instant of time, when Mike thought the chief would only dingle the key to the manacles in front of Mike's eyes and say,
sure, I'll let you out. When your 24 hours is up.
Why did you take me there, Daddy?
He asked on the way home.
You'll know when you're older, Will had replied.
You don't like Chief Borton, do you?
No,
his father had replied in a voice so curt that Mike hadn't dared ask anymore. But Mike enjoyed most of the places in Derry his father sent or took him to, and by the time Mike was 10, Will had succeeded in conveying his own interest in the layers of Derry's history to his son. Sometimes, as when he had been trailing his fingers over the slightly beveled surface of the stint in which the Memorial Park birdbath was set, or when he had squatted down to look more closely at the trolley tracks which grooved Mond Street in the Old Cape, he would be struck by a profound sense of time. Time as something real, as something that had seen weight, the way sunlight was supposed to have weight. Some of the kids in school had laughed when Mrs. Gringas told them that, but Mike had been too stunned by the concept to laugh. His first thought had been,
light has weight? Oh my lord, that's terrible.
Time as something that would eventually bore him. The first note his father left him in that spring of 1958 was scribbled on the back of an envelope and held down with a salt shaker. The air was spring warm, wonderfully sweet, and his mother had opened all the windows.
No chores, the note read. If you want to, ride your bike out to Pasty Road. You'll see a lot of tumbled masonry and old machinery out in the field on your left. Have a look around, bring back a souvenir. Don't go near the cellar hole, and be back before dark. You know why.
Mike knew why. All right. He told his mother where he was going, and she frowned.
Why don't you see if Randy Robinson wants to go with you?
Yeah, okay, I stop by and ask him, Mike said.
He did, too, but Randy had gone up to Bangor with his father to buy seedling potatoes. so Mike rode his bike over to Pester Road alone. It was a goodish ride, a little over 4 miles. Mike reckoned it was 3 o'clock by the time he leaned his bike against an old wooden slat fence on the left side of Pester Road and climbed into the field beyond. He would have maybe an hour to explore, and then he would have to start home again. Ordinarily, his mother would not be upset with him as long as he was back by 6, when she put dinner on the table. But one memorable episode had taught him that wasn't the case this year. On that one occasion, when he had been late for dinner, she had been nearly hysterical. She took after him with a dish rack, whooping him with it as he stood open mouthed in the kitchen entryway, his wicker curl with the rainbow throat in it at his feet.
"Don't you ever scare me like that,"
she had screamed.
Don't you ever.
Its ever had been punctuated by another dish rack shot. Mike had expected his father to step in and put a stop to it, but his father hadn't done so. Perhaps he knew that if he did, she would turn her wildcat anger on him as well. Mike had learned the lesson. One whooping with this rock was all it took. Home before dark. Yes, Mom. Righto. He walked across the field toward the titanic ruin standing in the center. This was, of course, the remains of the kitchen ironworks. He had ridden past it, but had never thought to actually explore it, and he had never heard any kid saying that they had. No, stooping to examine a few tumbled bricks that had formed a rough cairn, he thought he could understand why. The field was dazzlingly bright, washed by sun from the spring sky. Occasionally, as a cloud passed before the sun, a great shudder of shadow would travel slowly across the field. But there was something spooky about it all the same. A brooding silence that was broken only by the wind. He felt like an explorer who has found the last remnants of some fabulous lost city. Up ahead and to the right, he saw the rounded side of a massive tile cylinder rising out of the high field grass. He ran over to it. It was the ironworks' main smokestack. He peered into its bore and felt a fresh chill warm up his spine. It was big enough so he could have walked into it if he had wanted. But he didn't want to. God knew what strange cook there might be, clinging to the smoke-blackened inner tiles, or what nasty bugs or beasts might have taken up residence inside. The wind gusted. When it blew across the mouth of the fallen stack, it made a sound eerily like the sound of the wind vibrating the waxed strings he and his dad put in the moose blower's every spring. He stepped back nervously, suddenly thinking about the movie he and his father had watched last night on the Yule show. It had been called Rodan, and watching it had seemed like great fun at the time, his father laughing and shouting, "Get that bird, Mikey!" every time Rodan made its appearance, Mike shouting with his finger until his mom popped her head in and told them to hush up before they gave her a headache with the noise. It didn't seem so funny now. In the movie, Rodan had been released from the bowels of the earth by these Japanese coal miners who had been digging the world's deepest tunnel. And looking at the black bore of this pipe, it was all too easy to imagine that bird crouched at the far end, leathery bird-like wings folded over its back, staring at the small, round boy face looking into the darkness, staring, staring with its cold ringed eyes. Shivering, Mike pulled back. He walked a ways down the smokestack, which had sunken into the earth to half of its circumference. The land rose slightly, and on impulse, he scrambled his way up on top. The stack was a lot less scary on the outside, its tiled surface sun warm. He got to his feet and strolled along, holding his arms out. The surface was all too wide for him to need to worry about falling off, but he was pretending he was a tightwire walker in the circus, liking the way the wind blew through his hair. On the far end, he jumped down and began to examine stuff. More bricks, twisted molds, hunks of wood, pieces of rusty machinery. "Bring back a souvenir," his father's note had said. He wanted a good one. He wandered closer to the mill's yawning silver hold, looking at the doors, being careful not to cut himself on the broken glass. There was a lot of it around. Mike was not unmindful of the silver hold and his father's warning to stay out of it. Neither was he unmindful of the death that had been dealt out on this spot 50-odd years before. He supposed that if there was a haunted place in Dory, this was it. But either in spite of that or because of it, he was determined to stay until he found something really good to take back and show his father.
He moved slowly and soberly toward the cellar hold, changing his course to peril its rugged side, when a warning voice inside whispered that he was getting too close, that a bank weakened by the spring rains could crumble under his heels and pitch him into that hole, where God only knew how much sharp iron might be waiting to impale him like a bug, leaving him to die a rusty, twitching death. He picked up the window sash and dozed to the side. Here was a deeper beak, enough for a giant's table, its handle rippled and warped by some unimaginable flaws of it. Here was a piston too big for him to even budge, let alone lift. He stepped over it. He stepped over it and...
What if I find the skull? He thought suddenly. The skull of one of the kids who were killed here while they were hunting for chocolate Easter eggs back in 19, whenever it was.
He looked around the sun-washed empty field, nastily shocked by the idea. The wind blew a low conch note in his ears, and another shadow cursed silently across the field, like the shadow of a giant bat. Or bird. He became aware all over again of how quiet it was here, and how strange the field looked with its struggling piles of masonry and its bleached iron hulks leaning this way and that. It was as if some horrid battle had been fought here long ago.
Don't be such a deep, he replied uneasily to himself.
They found everything there was to find 50 years ago, after it happened, and even if they didn't, some other kid or grown-up would have found the rest since then. Or do you think you're the only person who ever came here hunting for souvenirs? No, I don't think that, but what?
That rational side of his mind demanded, and Mike thought it was talking just a little too loud, a little too fast.
Even if there was still something to find, it would have decayed long ago. So, what?
Mike found a splintered destroyer in the weeds. He glanced at it, tossed it aside, and moved a little closer to the cellar hold, where the stuff was thickest. Surely he would find something there.
But what if there are ghosts? But what? What if I see hands coming over the edge of that cellar hold, and what if they start to come up? Catching the remains of their Easter Sunday clothes, clothes that are all rotted and torn, marked with 50 years of spring mud and fall rain and caked winter snow. Kids with no heads.
He had heard at school that, after the explosion, a woman had found the head of one of the victims in a tree in her backyard.
Kids with no legs. Kids flayed open like codfish. Kids just like me who would maybe come down and play. Down there where it's dark, under the leaning iron girders and the big old rusty cooks. Oh, stop it, for the Lord's sake.
But the shoulder wrenched its way up his back and he decided it was time to take something, anything, and get the dickens out of here. He reached down, almost at random, and came up with a gear-toothed wheel about 7 inches in diameter. He had a pencil in his pocket and he used it, quickly, to dig the dirt out of the teeth. Then he slipped his souvenir in his pocket. He would go now. He would go. Yes. But his feet moved slowly in the wrong direction, toward the cellar hold, and he realized with a dismal sort of horror that he needed to look down inside. He had to see. He gripped a spongy support beam leaning out of the earth and swayed forward, trying to see down and inside. He couldn't quite do it. He could come to within 15 feet of the edge, but that was still a little too far to see the bottom of the cellar hold.
I don't care if I see the bottom or not. I'm going back now. I've got my souvenir. I don't need to look down into any crummy old hole, and Daddy's note said to stay away from it.
But the unhappy, almost feverish curiosity that had gripped him would not let go. He approached the cellar hold step by quizzy step, aware that as soon as the wooden beam was out of his reach, there would be no more grab holds. Also aware that the ground here was indeed squelchy and crumbly. In places along the edge he could see depressions, like graves that had fallen in, and knew that they were the sites of previous cave-ins. Heart thudding in his chest like the hard measured strides of a soldier's boots, he reached the edge and looked down. Nested in the cellar hold, the bird looked up. Mike was not at first sure what he was saying. All the nerves and pathways in his body seemed frozen, including those which conducted thoughts. It was not just the shock of seeing a monster bird, a bird whose breast was as orange as a robin's and whose feathers were the remarkable fluffy gray of a sparrow's feathers,
most of it was the shock of the utterly unexpected. He had expected monoliths of machinery, half-submerged and stagnant puddles, and black mud. Instead, he was looking down into a giant's nest, which filled the cellar hall from end to end and side to side. It had been made out of enough timothy grass to make a dozen bales of hay, but this grass was silvery and old. The bird sat in the middle of it, its brightly ringed eyes as black as fresh, warmed her, and for an insane moment before his paralysis broke, Mike could see himself reflected in each of them. Then, the ground suddenly began to shift and run out from beneath his feet. He heard the touring sound of shallow roads giving way and realized he was sliding. With a yell, he threw himself backward, pinwheeling his arms for balance. He lost it and thumped heavily to the littered ground. Some hard, dull chunk of metal pressed painfully into his back, and he had time to think of the drumcher before he heard the whirring, explosive sound of the bird's wings. He scrambled to his knees, crawled, looked back over his shoulder, and saw it rising out of the cellar hold. Its scaly talons were a dusky orange. Its vetting wings, each more than 10 feet across, blew the scraggy timothy grass this way and that, paternalistically, like the wind generated by helicopter rotors. It uttered a buzzing, chirruping scream. A few loose feathers slipped from its wings and spiraled back down into the cellar hold. Mike gained his feet again and began to run. He bounded across the field, not looking back now, afraid to look back. The bird did not look like Rodan, but he sensed it was the spirit of Rodan, risen from the cellar hold of the Kitchener Ironworks like a horrible bird in the box. He stumbled, went to one knee, got up, and ran on. That weird, chirruping, buzzing screech came again. A shadow covered him, and when he looked up, he saw the thing. It had buzzed less than 5 feet over his head. Its beak, dirty yellow, opened and closed, revealing a pink lining inside. It whirled back to Warmack. The wind it generated washed across his face, bringing a dry and pleasant smell with it. Earthic dust, dead antiques, rotting cushions. He jerked to his left, and now he saw the fallen smoke stack again. He sprinted for it, running all out, his arms pumping in short jobbing strokes at his sides. The bird screamed, and he heard its fluttering wings. They sounded like sails. Something slammed into the back of his head. Warm fire traced its way up the nape of his neck. He felt it spread as blood began to trickle down the back of his shirt collar. The bird whirled around again, meaning to pick him up with its talons and carry him away like a hawk with a field mouse. Meaning to carry him back to its nest, meaning to eat him. As it flew at him, swooping down, its black, horribly alive eyes fixed on him, Mike could sharply write. The bird missed him, barely. The dusty smell of its wings was overpowering, unbearable. Now he was running parallel to the fallen smokestack, its tails roaring by. He could see where it ended. If he could reach the end and bottom hook to the left, get inside, he might be safe. He thought the bird was too big to squeeze inside. He came very close to not making it. The bird flew at him again, pulling up as it closed in, its wings flopping and pushing her in a hurricane, its scaly talons now angled toward him and descending. It screamed again, and this time Mike thought he heard triumph in its voice. He lowered his head, put his arm up, and rammed straight forward. The talons closed, and for a moment the bird had him by the forearm. The grip was like the clutch of incredibly strong fingers tipped with tough nails. They beat like teeth. The bird's flapping wings were a thunder in his ears. He was dimly aware of feathers falling around him. Some brushing past his cheeks like phantom kisses. The bird rose then, and for just a moment, Mike felt himself pulled upward, first straight, then on tiptoe. And for one freezing second, he felt the toes of his cat's loose contact with the earth. "Let me go!" he screamed at it, and twisted his arm. For a moment, the talons held on, and then the sleeve of his shirt ripped. He thumped back down. The bird squalled. Mike ran again, brushing through the thing's still feathers, gawking at that dry smell. It was like running through a shower curtain of feathers. Still coughing,
eyes stinging from both tears, and whatever vile dust coated the bird's feathers, he stumbled into the fallen smokestack. There was no thought now of what might be lurking inside. He ran into the darkness, his gasping sobs taking on a flat echo. He went back perhaps 20 feet, and then turned toward the bright circle of daylight. His chest was rising and falling in quick jerks. He was suddenly aware that if he had misjudged either the size of the bird or the size of the smokestack's muscle, he had killed himself as surely as if he had put his father's shotgun to his head and pulled the trigger. There was no way out. This wasn't just a pipe. It was a blind alley. The other end of the stack was buried in the earth. The bird squalled again, and suddenly the light at the end of the smokestack was blotted out as it lighted on the ground outside. He could see its yellow scaly legs, each as thick as a moon's calves. Then it cocked its head down and looked inside. Mike found himself again staring into those hideously bright fresh star eyes with their gold wedding rings of iris. The bird's beak opened and closed, opened and closed, and each time it snapped shut, he heard an audible click, like the sound you hear in your own ears when you snap your teeth together hard. Sharp, he thought. Its beak is sharp. I guess I knew birds had sharp beaks, but I never really thought about it until now. It squawked again. The sound was so loud in the tile throat of the stack that Mike clapped his hands to his ears. The bird began to force itself into the mouth of the stack.
No,
Mike cried.
No, you can't.
The light faded as more of the bird's body pressed its way into the stack's bore.
Oh, my lord, why didn't I remember it was mostly feathers? Why didn't I remember it could squeeze?
The light faded. Faded. Was gone. Now there was only an inky blackness, the suffocating gothic smell of the bird, and the rustling sound of its feathers. Mike fell on his knees and began to grope on the curved floor of the smokestack, his hands spread wide, feeling. He found a piece of broken tile, its sharp edges furred with what felt like moss. He cocked his arm back and pegged it. There was a thump. The bird uttered its buzzing, chirping sound again.
Get out of here!
Mike screamed. There was silence. And then that crackly, rustling sound began again as the bird resumed forcing itself into the pipe. Mike felt along the floor, found other pieces of tile, and began to throw one after another. They thumped and thudded off the bird and then clinged to the tile sleep of the smokestack.
Please, God,
Mike thought incoherently.
Please, God, please, God, please, God.
It came to him that he ought to retreat down the smokestack's bore. He had run in through what had been the stack space. It stood to reason that it would narrow as he backed up. He could retreat, yes, and listen to that low dusty rustle as the bird worked its way in after him. He could retreat, and if he was lucky, he might get beyond the point where the bird could continue to advance.
But what if the bird got stuck?
If that happened, he and the bird would die in here together. They would die in here together, and rot in here together, in the dark.
Please, God,
he screamed, and was totally unaware that he had cried out aloud. He threw another piece of tile, and this time his throw was more powerful. He felt, he told the others much later, as if someone were behind him at that moment, and that someone had given his arm a tremendous push. This time, there was no feathery thud. Instead, there was a splotting sound. The sound a kid's hand might make slapping into the surface of a bowl of half-solidified yellow. This time, the bird screamed not in anger, but in real pain. The tenuous whir of its wings filled the smokestack. Stinking air streamed past Mike in a hurricane, flapping his clothes, making him cough and gag and retreat as dust and moss flew. Light appeared again, grey and weak at first, then brightening and shifting as the bird retreated from the stack's muzzle. Mike burst into tears, fell to his knees again, and began groving madly for more pieces of tile. Without any conscious thought, he ran forward with both hands full of tiling. In this light he could see the pieces were splotched with blue-grey moss and lichen, like the surface of slate gravestones, until he was nearly at the mouth of the stack. He intended to keep the bird from coming back in, if he could. It burned down, cocking its head the way a trained bird on a perch will sometimes cock its head, and Mike saw where his last shot had struck home. The bird's right eye was nearly gone. Instead of that glittering bubble of frost ore, there was a crater filled with blood. White as grey goo dripped from the corner of the socket and trickled along the side of the bird's beak. Tiny parasites wriggled and screamed in this pussy discharge. It shook him and lunged forward. Mike began to throw chunks of tile at it. This struck its head on Beak. It withdrew for a moment and then lunged again. Beak opening, revealing that pink lining again, revealing something else that caused Mike to freeze for a moment, his own mouth dropping open. The bird's tongue was silver, its surface as crazy cracked as the surface of a volcanic lund which has first baked and then slugged off. And on this tongue, like weird tumbleweeds that had taken temporary root there, were a number of orange puffs. Mike threw the last of his tiles directly into that gaping maw, and the bird withdrew again, screaming its frustration, rage, and pain. For a moment, Mike could see its reptilian talons. Then its wings ruffled the air, and it was gone. A moment later, he lifted his face, a face that was grey-brown under the dirt, dust, and bits of moss that the bird's wind machine wings had blown at him, toward the clicking sound of its talons on the dial. The only clean places on Mike's face were the tracks that had been washed clean by his tears. The bird walked back and forth overhead. Tuk, 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 tuk. Mike retreated a bit, gathered up more chunks of tile, and kept them as close to the mouth of the stack as he dared. If the thing came back, he wanted to be able to fire at it from point-blank range. The light outside was still bright. Now that it was May, it wouldn't get dark for a long time yet. But suppose the bird just decided to wait? Mike swallowed, the dry sides of his throat rubbing together for a moment. Overhead, tuk, tuk, tuk. He had a fine pile of ammunition now. In the dim light, here, beyond the place where the angle of the sun made the shadow, spiral inside the pipe, it looked like a pile of broken crockery swept together by a housewife. Mike rubbed the palms of his dirty hands along the sides of his jeans and waited to see what would happen next. A space of time passed before something did. Whether 5 minutes or 25, he could not tell. He was only aware of the bird walking back and forth overhead, like an insomniac pacing the floor at 3 in the morning. Then, its wings fluttered again. It landed in front of the smokestack's opening. Mike, on his knees, just behind his pile of tiling, began to pick missiles at it before it could even bend its head down. One of them slumped into a plated yellow leg and drew a trickle of blood so dark it seemed almost as black as the bird's eyes. Mike screamed in triumph, the sound thin and almost lost under the bird's own enraged squawk.
"Get out of here!" Mike cried. "I'm going to keep hitting you until you get out of here. I swear to God I will."
The bird flew up to the top of the smokestack and resumed its pacing. Mike waited. Finally, its wings ruffled again as it took off. Mike waited, expecting the yellow feet, so like hen's feet, to appear again. They didn't. He waited longer, convinced it had to be some kind of a trick, realizing at last that that wasn't why he was waiting at all. He was waiting because he was scared to go out, scared to leave the safety of this bolt hole.
Never mind stuff like that. I'm not a rabbit.
He took as many chunks of tile as he could handle comfortably, then put some more inside his shirt. He stepped out of the smokestack, trying to look everywhere at once, and wishing madly for eyes in the back of his head. He saw only the field stretching ahead and around him, littered with exploded rusting remains of the kitchen ironworks. He wheeled around. Sure, he would see the bird perched on the lip of the stack like a vulture, a one-eyed vulture now, only wanting the boy to see him before it attacked for the final time, using that sharp beak to jump and rip and strip. But the bird was not there. It was really gone. Mike's nerve snapped. He uttered a breaking scream of fear and ran for the weather-beaten fence between the field and the road, dropping the last piece of tile from his hands. Most of the others fell out of his shirt as the shirt pulled free of his belt. He vaulted over the fence one-handed, like Roy Rogers showing off for Dale Evans on his way back from the corral with Pat Brady and the rest of the bookers. He grabbed the handlebars of his bike and ran beside it 40 feet up the road before getting on. Then he pedaled madly, not daring to look back, not daring to slow down, until he reached the intersection of Pasture Road and Outer Main Street, where there were lots of cars passing back and forth. When he got home, his father was changing the plugs on the tractor. Will observed that Mike looked powerful, musty and dusty. Mike hesitated for just a split second and then told his father that he'd taken a tumble from his bike on the way home, swerving to avoid a pothole.
"Did you break anything, Mikey?" Will asked, observing his son a little more carefully.
"No, sir."
"Sprains?"
"Sir,"
Mike nodded. "Did you pick yourself up a souvenir?"
Mike reached into his pocket and found the gear wheel. He showed it to his father, who looked at it briefly and then plucked a tiny crumb of tiling from the pot of flesh just below Mike's thumb. He seemed more interested in this.
"From that old smokestack?" Will asked.
Mike nodded.
"You go inside there." Mike nodded again. "See anything in there?" Will asked. And then, as if to make a joke of the question, which hadn't sounded like a joke at all, he added,
"Buried treasure?"
Smiling a little, Mike shook his head.
"Well, don't tell your mother you were smacking about in there," Will said. "She'd shoot me first, and you second."
He looked even more closely at his son.
"Mikey, are you right?"
"Huh?
You look a little peaky around the eyes."
"I guess I might be a little tired," Mike said. "It's 8 or 10 miles there and back again. Don't forget, you want some help with the tractor, Daddy?"
"No, I'm about done screwing it up for this week. You go on, in, and wash up."
Mike started away, and then his father called to him once more. Mike looked back.
"I don't want you going around that place again," he said. "At least not until all this trouble is cleared up and they catch the man who's doing it. You didn't see anybody out there, did you? No one chased you or hollered you down?"
"I didn't see any people at all," Mike said.
Will nodded and lit a cigarette.
"I think I was wrong to send you there. Old places like that, sometimes they can be dangerous."
Their eyes looked briefly.
"Okay, Daddy," Mike said. "I don't want to go back anyway. It was a little spooky."
Will nodded again.
"Less said, the better, I reckon. You go and get cleaned up now, and tell her to put on 3 or more extra sausages."
Mike did. 6.
"Never mind that now," Mike Almond thought, looking at the groups which went up to the concrete edge of the canal and stopped there. "Never mind that. It might just have been a dream anyhow, and..."
There were splotches of dried blood on the lip of the canal. Mike looked at this, and then he looked down into the canal. Black water flowed smoothly past. Runners of dirty yellow foam clung to the canal sides, sometimes breaking free to flow downstream in lazy loops and curves. For a moment, just a moment, two clots of this foam came together and seemed to form a face. A kid's face.
Its eyes turned up in an avatar of terror and agony.
Mike's breath cut, as if on a thorn. The foam broke apart, became meaningless again, and at that moment there was a loud splash on his right. Mike snapped his head around, shrinking back a little, and for a moment he believed he saw something in the shadows of the outflow tunnel where the canal resurfaced after its curse under Downtown. Then it was gone. Suddenly, cold and shuddering, he dug in his pocket for the knife he had found in the grass. He threw it into the canal. There was a small splash, a ripple that began as a circle and was then tugged into the shape of a narrow head by the current. Then, nothing. Nothing except the fear that was suddenly suffocating him and the deathly certainty that there was something near, something watching him, gauging its chances, biding its time. He turned, meaning to walk back to his bike. To run would be to dignify those fears and then dignify himself. And then that splashing sound came again. It was a lot louder this second time. So much for dignity. Suddenly he was running as fast as he could, beating his boons for the gate and his bike, jumping the kickstand up with one heel and pedaling for the street as fast as he could. That sea smell was all at once too thick. Much too thick. It was everywhere. And the water, dripping from the wet branches of the trees, seemed much too loud. Something was coming. He heard dragging, lurching footsteps in the grass. He stood on the pedals, giving it everything, and shot out onto Main Street without looking back. He headed for home as fast as he could, wondering what in hell had possessed him to come in the first place, what had drawn him. And then he tried to think about the chores, the world chores, and nothing but the chores. After a while, he actually succeeded. And when he saw the headline in the paper the next day, "Missing boy prompts new fears," he thought about the pocket knife he had thrown into the gunwale. The pocket knife with the initials EC scratched on the side. He thought about the blood he had seen on the grass. And he thought about those groups which stopped at the edge of the gunwale.